This is Your Life is Their Toy, Merchants in Medicine, by Dr. Emmanuel Josephson, from 1948. This is Part 16. Notable Advance, Wisconsin Preceptor System. There is one notable exception in this country, in the low caliber of medical undergraduate instruction. At the University of Wisconsin, Dean Bardeen has honestly and intelligently acknowledged the inadequacy of classroom medical instruction and has restored the quote-unquote old-fashioned preceptor system. Early in the course of medical training, the students at the university are sent out to work as assistants to practicing physicians to acquire skill in the art of medicine. Dean Bardeen deserves the thanks of the nation if this precedent will lead to a breakdown of the medical school teaching rackets and to the institution of adequate training for the medical students. Glenn Frank, as president of the University of Wisconsin, wrote an enthusiastic report of this improvement in medical education for a 1931 issue of the Wisconsin Alumni Magazine. He related that students of medicine of the university were sent as far afield as Chicago to work directly under the supervision of practicing physicians. He stated, quote, "Students are receiving, in the opinion of many competent observers, more careful personal instruction in clinical medicine than is provided in any other school," unquote. Nepotism and favoritism in medical education. Within the last several decades, in increasing degree, intelligence and aptitude are being eliminated, even in the requisites for admission to medical schools. Students are selected primarily for religion, wealth, submissiveness, subservience, and docility to ensure that they will fit into the corrupt system. In some of the medical schools that are more completely controlled by the foundations and the Bismarckian propagandists, adherence to Marxian doctrines is an important consideration for admission. Thus, the profession is becoming filled with communist-Nazi propagandists and agents. To cap the climax of inadequacy of university medical training, nepotism and dishonest practices are still as widespread as they were in the early days, in aiding inadequately trained and incompetent students to obtain medical degrees. Promotion and graduation are rarely dependent upon a thorough knowledge of the subject. They are dependent upon cramming and passing examinations. The dishonest practice of giving the favored few, or even the favored fraternity, a list of examination questions in advance of the examination is not unknown in the medical schools of the country. In my last year at the College of Physicians and Surgeons, Dean Lambert undertook to question the 10 highest students in the class, who had been included in the honor roll just read by him, on an elementary subject in medicine. The honor roll students failed ignominiously. They made a disgraceful exhibition from which they were belatedly rescued by loud promptings by less favored members of the class. This was condoned and overlooked by the dean to save his face. Postgraduate medical education rackets. Racketeering in medical training does not cease with the undergraduate medical school. Although, in theory, graduate medical training might supplement and correct the inadequacies of undergraduate medical training, this is precluded in practice by the intensity of racketeering in the graduate medical schools. Most of the graduate medical schools are proprietary institutions. In many of them, professorships and instructorships in the various subjects have been sold to the highest bidder. In some of them, such as the College of Physicians and Surgeons, which was subsequently merged with the University of Illinois, the sale of a job was disguised by the sale of stock in the institution. Dr. G. Frank Lidston, in his book entitled Why the American Medical Association is Going Backward, A Critique of the Medical Trust, mentions his holdings of the College of Physicians and Surgeons stock. It readily can be understood that those who purchase professorships and instructorships hope to make handsome returns on their investments through consultations and through the reference to themselves of cases and operations. If the subject matter of the specialty should become too widely known among practicing physicians, or if the postgraduate students learned too much, the chances of a return on the investment would be minimized. Therefore, the opportunities offered to physicians for postgraduate and special instructions are highly restricted. For purposes of restriction and monopoly of the specialties, the cost of graduate instruction is made high in time and money as compared with the means and earnings of the members of the profession. Sounds like all colleges today. In the graduate schools, the bulk of the instruction, even in the surgical specialties, which especially require actual technical training, practice, and experience, is almost entirely by lecture and rote. To acquire even this special instruction, a physician must give up as much as 3 years of his time for a single subject and expend thousands of dollars. Medical education does not terminate with schooling. Throughout his life as a practitioner, a physician must continue his education. Each day adds a new bit to the meager stock of medical science. Medical journals, scientific journals, newspapers, books, and libraries are essential to the physician and to the welfare of the patients who entrust their lives to his care. All of these have been converted into rackets by organized medicine. Abuse of licensing powers. For the purpose of holding down competition, the number of students admitted to medical training is being severely restricted by organized medicine. Only a small percent of the total number of acceptable applicants is being admitted each year to the medical schools in this country. For a time, it was pretended that the reason for restriction was the limited capacities of the schools. The sham of this pretense became clear when the AMA and the licensing boards of the various states that it controls reached overseas and intimidated foreign universities from accepting American students. The foreign universities were threatened with removal from the list of those which are recognized as giving a course acceptable for American licensure. It was a neat bit of international blackmail that was made possible by the gang's control of the boards that license medical practice. Medical licensing powers are as often misused by organized medicine today as they were a century ago. History repeats itself. Chapter 8, Medical Research and the Medical Rackets. In their quote-unquote reorganization of the AMA, it was natural that quote-unquote Doc Simmons and his gang should consider medical research primarily from the commercial angles, advertising, publicity, and resultant profits. With those objectives in mind, they proceeded to fasten their grip on research by means of every agency that they controlled. It is not surprising, therefore, that supposedly humanitarian research is now often a blind for commercialism and racketeering. The history of the attitude of organized medicine toward medical research even before this period was quite shameful. Few of the significant medical discoveries which were to change the entire future of the field had been made by doctors. The majority of these discoveries were made by laymen. Medicine's ignorance versus wisdom of tradition. In the present century, the work of the biologic chemists in the field of food and nutrition was ridiculed by organized medicine. Informed and thinking men who recognized the value of this work and adopted it in the prevention and treatment of human disease were assailed and labeled faddists and quacks. Such men as Bernard McFadden and Alfred W. McCann have done more to introduce a sane mode of eating and living than whole packs of medical quote-unquote authorities. With sound common sense, they trusted the age-old folklore and tradition of health and medicine and observation of man and enunciated truths which were not accepted by pompous and dim-witted quote-unquote medical science until it could understand the confirmation of rats and guinea pigs. In spite of advances made during the past century, medicine and biology have scarcely begun to scratch the surface of their basic sciences. It is upon the foundation of these sciences, and upon medical research, that medicine's future of service to mankind depends. There are few, if any, of even the commoner ailments of mankind that have been studied more than superficially by modern medical science. Colds, for instance, are little less than a riddle today than they were to the primitive medicine of Hippocrates and Galen many centuries ago. The yogis of ancient India understood them better than do our modern quote-unquote scientists. And they taught correctly that proper breathing, pranayama, they called the exercises, is essential to good health. So fundamental a matter as the body's use and exchange of water, which constitutes over 80% of its substance, barely has been explored. Many of the things which have been accepted as facts by modern medical science on further study and deeper knowledge have proved to be dangerous half-truths and wholly untrue in some cases. On the other hand, many of the medical ideas and remedies which have evolved through the ages on the basis of clinical observation and judgment have been rejected categorically as quote-unquote empiric and valueless by young and arrogant quote-unquote medical science, merely to be readopted when this pseudo-science had learned enough to realize its errors and limitations. Numerous such instances might be quoted. Thus, Ma Wang, an herb which has been used by the Chinese since time immemorial, was abandoned by modern quote-unquote scientific medicine as utterly valueless. Within the past decade, Dr. Chen, a young Chinese pharmacologist, isolated from Ma Wang one of our most powerful and valuable drugs, ephedrine. In addition to a number of other valuable actions, ephedrine is now used to cause constriction of blood vessels and to control hemorrhage, medicine's intolerance. Half a century ago, medical science read with intolerant amusement the list of remedies which Macbeth's witches placed in the cauldron. Fillet of a fenny snake. In the cauldron, boil and bake. Eye of newt and toe of frog. Wool of bat and tongue of dog. Adder's fork and blind worm's sting. Lizard's leg and howlet's wing. For a charm of powerful trouble, like a hell broth boil and bubble. Today this passage finds its counterpart in the catalogue of any pharmaceutical house marketing biologic and endocrine products. These instances might be multiplied indefinitely, but they suffice to show how necessary it is for human welfare that medical research continuously explore new fields of science while not ignoring tradition. The meaning of the traditional display of ignorance, bigotry, intolerance, and stupidity in opposition to medical discovery becomes more obvious from a study of the real and fictitious discoveries that have been accepted quickly, sometimes too quickly. Quote-unquote, discoverers of liver therapy in anemia. The use of liver in the treatment of anemia is an old household remedy that was scorned by, quote-unquote, scientific medicine. A number of inquiring students in the first two decades of this century confirmed the value of the household remedy. Their papers on the subject were barred from effective publication in the widely read medical journals controlled by the AMA. Dr. Victor Heiser states in You're the Doctor, on the authority of the eminent pathologist Dr. William G. McCallum, quote, a man named William B. Castle had worked out why people would recover from anemia if they ate liver, but he was too late in publishing the result of his work, unquote. Three medical school professors, Minot, Murphy, and Whipple, whose influence in the circles of organized medicine is indicated by their positions, announced the quote-unquote discovery of the value of liver in the treatment of anemia. They received a Nobel Prize for the quote-unquote discovery, and drug firms coined fortunes from the sale of liver concoctions. Quote-unquote discovery of pneumonia, quote-unquote cure. Medical research institutes became interested in the subject of the treatment of pneumonia about two decades ago. Research workers characteristically remained in the rut of orthodox medical thought regarding infection and immunity. Dr. Cronin has portrayed in The Citadel the dangers to which original thought exposes research workers. Diphtheria, antitoxic serum, and the immunologic concepts of Ehrlich have established the beaten path for the quest of the means of conquest of infections. Stubbornly and slavishly, the workers followed that path in the quest of a serum for the treatment of pneumonia. It was found at the start that pneumococcus germs could be grouped on the basis of chemical reactions in the test tube into four groups or types. These types were later found to owe their individual peculiarities to the overcoat or capsule with which nature provides them. The death rate of the disease caused by these types of germs varies widely. The highest death rate is caused by what is known as group 3. Serums were prepared for each of these types of germs by their injection into horses or rabbits. When patients were treated with them, it was found that there was no material difference in the death rate as compared with the untreated cases. Though of practically no value in the prevention of death from pneumonia, the serum itself may cause menace to the health and life of the patient, as may any other serum. The research workers in the field refuse to acknowledge the obvious failure of the anti-pneumococcus serums. Their position and influence enable them to maintain themselves as quote-unquote authorities and to force the acceptance of their obviously erroneous views. They created numerous refinements in the typing of germs, which progressively increased the number of types from 4 to over 30, this enabled them to place the blame for the failure of the serum on the method of typing. The greater number of types made it more readily possible to manipulate the results obtained in such manner as to make the serum appear a bit more successful. But the total death rate of all types of pneumonia was not materially reduced. On the basis of this quote-unquote statistical approach, anti-pneumococcus serum was advertised to both the medical profession and the public as a success. The serum was quote-unquote accepted by the Council on Pharmacy and Chemistry of the American Medical Association and gained a place as a supposedly reliable remedy. Censorship of medical news in the lay press by organized medicine and its allies enabled intensive publicity in favor of the serum. Pneumonia serum business. From the financial viewpoint, anti-pneumococcus serum has been a huge success to its marketers. A highly lucrative business in the sale of the serum has been built up by a number of drug concerns. Among them is Lederle Laboratories, which is a subsidiary of American Cyanamid Company. Whether one of the earlier sponsors of the serum, the Rockefeller Institute, has any stock of these concerns among its holdings is not known. For the Rockefeller Institute, in sharp contrast with the Rockefeller Foundation, refuses to publish a list of its stock holdings. Especially good business are the sales of the serums to health departments. Thus, New York, following a campaign in the New York Post, appropriated in 1 year $100,000 for the purchase of the anti-pneumococcus serum. Presumably, it was intended for distribution to the needy. Lederle Laboratories sold the serum to the city. Health departments have established special divisions for pneumonia, which are charged with the distribution of the serum. The divisions do their utmost to make a statistical and business success of the serum. There is a surprising uniformity in the price charged for the serum by various manufacturers. Thanks to this price fixing, it has been estimated that the average cost of serum for the treatment of a case of pneumonia is $72. This cost amounts to almost twice the average cost of medical care per family per year. Obviously, serum is a good business proposition. This concludes part 16 of Your Life Is Their Toy, Merchants in Medicine by Dr. Emmanuel Josephson from 1948.